Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. You know, we hope you love the show and that you'll want more. Well, never fear. You can find more info on everything you hear at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, info on all of our guests and their books, and you can subscribe to our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you delicious things to make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. This week, we're diving into a master's take on cooking with vegetables with Michelin-starred chef Daniel Patterson. We look at Buddhist cooking in Japan, and starting things out this hour, we're going to do some thinking about women in the kitchen. Amanda Cohen is the chef owner of Dirt Candy in New York City, where the food is playful, punny, and creative. But on top of her chef cred, Amanda is a sharp-eyed and hilarious critic of celebrity chefs, the food media, and most pointedly, sexism in the food world. A few years back, she took on Time magazine when they did a cover story called The Gods of Food, which included 100 chefs, not a single one of them women. So why is the restaurant world such a boys' club? Amanda has some thoughts on why the fight can be harder outside the kitchen than inside. So Amanda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are a busy person. You're still the kind of chef who is in your restaurant cooking, literally cooking every day. But you've taken a lot of time to research the history of women chefs and to write about it. And, you know, I learned from you, there was a woman named Eugénie Brasier,
right,
who was the first chef to ever win 6 Michelin stars, which is huge.
Huge.
But I'd never heard, and I'm pretty much a geek about stuff, but I'd never heard of her. So why do you think women chefs have such a hard time getting recognition or attention?
Well, it's sort of this cycle that happens. Women need to be written about to get the attention. And the more attention they get, the more customers that fill their seats. The more customers that fill their seats, the more articles that are written about them. And it cycles and cycles and cycles. Without getting the attention in the press, the investors don't invest in them. And without, you know, getting bigger restaurants, they don't get more articles written about them. So it's just this never-ending cycle. Hmm. I don't know why, like, from the get-go, the press didn't start writing about the women. I can't go back that far in history. But I do know right now that they're still not writing about them.
But you've said before that there's a distinction between being a working chef as a woman and being the kind of chef the media likes to talk about. What does that mean?
Well, I think the media likes to sort of like focus on like the young, brassy, outspoken chefs who have time to step outside their kitchen and network and meet people. Whereas a lot of like the working chefs were in our kitchens every single night. There is no time. There's no extra time to leave your kitchen. And also women tend to open smaller restaurants, like the corner shops, mom and pop shops, ethnic restaurants. And we don't have a lot of extra money to spend on PR. So without a big, huge publicity company pushing you out there, how is the press going to find you?
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like you're treated differently because you're a woman?
I sometimes do feel like I'm treated differently. I've run my restaurant and we are very successful, I think. It takes 2 months to get a reservation. But even this past weekend, I had a very cocky young chef mansplain to me how to be more successful and, you know, what I could do to get investors and how he was able to get investors. And it's because I didn't try hard enough.
And you don't think he would have done that to another male chef?
I think another male chef might have punched him. He was lucky I was a little tipsy.
Is there a difference in your mind between male chefs and female chefs?
No, not at all. I think we cook the exact same way. I hate this argument when we start breaking it down and who's a better cook or do women cook more nurturing and, you know, men are more out there and they do more like modern techniques. No, everybody cooks the exact same way. Some people have the ability to try new things because let's say they have restaurants that have more money behind them, so they're able to take more chances or they can make fancier menus, they can do tasting menus. Again, women are opening smaller restaurants where they're not always able to take those chances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like every few years there is a conversation that sort of floats in some small corner of the media about, you know, about this idea, this idea of, you know, gender in the kitchen. You've said you don't find the world of cooking to be, quote unquote, a boys' club. What do you mean by that? Because people think of it as it being very male-driven, very, very male-dominated, and very testosterone-y.
Right. Well, I don't think that there's a group of men who are ruling this industry and they sit, you know, in a lounge smoking their cigar saying, hey, I'm a male chef and I'm going to make sure that no other female chef succeeds because I want to stay on top of this. I can't imagine that's what happened. I mean, maybe it does and I just don't know about the secret society. I've never been invited, but I really don't. I think that most chefs are, we all have huge egos. We all want to succeed the most, but I also don't want to do it to the detriment of somebody else. You know, I really want everybody else to have the same chances that I have. I imagine the same thing for male chefs. They want to know they're the best chef because they're the best chef, not because they have male genitalia.
Yeah. Like they, no one wants to win when they know they have when they know they have a leg up.
Yeah, exactly.
A friend of mine who is a woman in the food world once said to me, you know, I hate to say it, but the reason there aren't that many women chefs is actually simple. And she said, you know, to make it as a chef, you have to usually devote your 20s, your strongest years, entirely to the kitchen. And that's when many women want to have families. And so they, maybe they have children, they decide they need more time with their children, or, you know, like what Sheryl Sandberg talks about.
Right.
They sort of think, well, you know, in a few years, I'm going to be out of this anyway, so I don't really, you know, they don't quote unquote lean into it. What do you think of that idea? And what can we do about it?
Totally true. I think we have a huge problem in this industry. We do not, and this is going to sound funny, but we're not keeping women in the kitchen. We need to keep women in the kitchen. They don't have to be barefoot, but they have to be in the kitchen. And this is a problem in the industry side. So a lot of the things I talk about is more about in the press. But for us, this is our huge problem. We don't offer, most restaurants don't offer maternity leave. You know, we don't have healthcare in the restaurant industry. It's starting, but it hasn't really happened yet. And this is something that we as restaurateurs have to figure out. How can we keep women in the kitchen? How can we let them go for, you know, 6 months or a year, however much time they want to take off, and then come back and have a decent life, you know, earn a decent salary and be able to spend time with their kids? This is something I think we're going to start figuring out. I think we're going to have to in the next couple of years, but we haven't had to. This has sort of been an unregulated industry. And what's happened is we've lost all this talent. All these great chefs have left in their 20s and early 30s, all these female chefs, and they haven't come back or they've gone to different parts of the industry. And what we need to do is find them again and say, hey, show us what you can do.
Right.
This is another one of my big issues, but food costs money, but you're not paying as much as it costs to sit in my restaurant to eat that food. And that's where we're going to start seeing this come out, is that as a community, we're all going to have to agree that our, $15 salad might cost $20 if the people who are making it are, we have to decide if they're entitled to have the same rights as we do as a consumer. So it's a problem for everybody, but we are going to have to tackle it, or we're just going to keep losing people.
Right. Do you think there is a woman who's working as a chef today who's doing a really good job in putting herself out there in a non-gendered way?
I think a perfect example is Alex Wright. She owns three restaurants in New York, Chiquito, La Vara, and El Quinto Pinto. And she's sort of an empire builder. She is a mother, and she is putting herself out there all the time. I see her at parties. I see her at events, food events. She's networking. And people know who she is. She writes. She's always in magazines. She's the perfect person, kind of.
She's actually really interesting, too, because I mean, she's super smart and her food is terrific.
Yeah.
But it's also an interesting scenario where she's actually co-chef in all of her restaurants with her husband and partner. And it's an interesting thing where almost always when that happens, when there's a couple, it's the man who's like, who either gets the attention, or the man is the savory chef and the woman tends to be the pastry chef and is sort of secondary because of that. But this is a situation where they are both co-chefs, both the savory chefs, and yet people know her and talk about her and not him.
Exactly. She has broke the mold in so many different ways.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today, Amanda.
No, thank you for having me.
Amanda Cohen is the chef owner of Dirt Candy New York City, and she left us with a recipe for her signature portobello mousse. You can find it at splendidtable.org. So here we are today, you know, talking to people about food on the radio. And we get to cover it from all kinds of angles. Stories and cooking and histories and science and all the rest. Or, you know, you can go out and find fascinating food essays in all kinds of places. Or you can even get a literal PhD in food studies. But back in the 50s and 60s, before we had all this food media everywhere, you'd mostly find food written about in a newspaper section called, pointedly, the women's pages. And I always imagined quote-unquote serious news editors at the time saying that phrase with kind of a sneer. And, you know, with a dash or, you know, half a cup of sexism of my own, I assumed they were just piles of recipes from corporate sponsors and coupons. But Hannah Raskin, a newspaper woman herself, looked into the history of the women's pages and found a much richer story and a few of the fascinating women who edited them. Hannah, so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So I think I was pretty wrong about what the women's pages were, but can you tell us what they really were and how they started?
Absolutely. A lot of people got the women's pages wrong because a lot of people didn't read them, and by a lot of people, I mean men. And it really, that granted a measure of freedom to the women who edited and wrote for these pages that they really exercised and enjoyed. So you're absolutely right that there were corporate recipes that showed up on those pages. There were also plenty of reader-submitted recipes, recipes from the food editor herself. But you often had a lot of kind of Q&A format. And in that space where, you know, women who were cooking or taking care of their home, they would ask for help with this or help with that. And oftentimes these would become somewhat political discussions. Sometimes they needed help with figuring out how to, you know, find daycare for their kids. Sometimes they needed help with transportation to the supermarket. And a lot of these political issues filtered into what was supposedly a page about food.
What do you mean by they were political issues?
There was plenty of discussion of food stamps and school lunch, you know, issues as to how the government should or should not support farmers. I mean, things that were probably being covered elsewhere, but here they were being covered through the lens of food.
Yeah. And you found the stories and looked into the stories of some of these editors who were doing really interesting stuff.
Absolutely. So there are a number of these women, and I do want to credit Kim Voss, who's an academic who's really started, you know, pulling some of these names from the archives and finding some of their work. What brings them together is really what unifies food writers today. They had tremendous curiosity. They were very courageous. And that courage sometimes came into play in their own workplaces. They had to deal with what was essentially a gender segregated workplace in many cases. They would be sent to a room sometimes on a different floor so that they wouldn't be exposed to the cigar smoke and curse words that personified newsrooms at that time. In a lot of cases, they never got married, either because they were independent and chose not to, or as some of them have since said or did say, the job didn't allow them to. I mean, these were really women who were devoted to their work. So the first woman I really got a chance to familiarize myself with was the woman who held the position I now hold, which is a food editor at the what is now the Post and Courier. It was a different paper at the time. And she was very typical of these women in that she was born in Canada and started, you know, in journalism at a fairly young age, loved it, was just very excited by, you know, the whole prospect of breaking news and communicating with an audience. But her marriage didn't go well, and so she wanted a divorce, which at the time in Canada literally required an act of parliament. So she moved to Reno, came for a quickie divorce, and met someone there who suggested Charleston. In Charleston, she became food editor at the paper and just flourished. I mean, just, you know, did a wonderful job. Never gave up the Canadian tradition of drinking scotch and ginger ale. Loved stories and kept that food page going for decades.
Yeah. And you also looked into the story of a woman named Eleanor Lee.
Yeah, so Eleanor Lee I came to know when I was doing research into the chef's tournament that was held in Virginia in the late 40s. She was considered then a very authoritative panelist. They had sought her out to lend some expertise to this competition. Eleanor Lee had a radio show first and then ended up becoming the food editor for the Washington Post. And she really was a trailblazer in some of the political stuff. She, like many of her counterparts, did a fantastic job of making women feel okay about making choices in the kitchen, making choices to not be in the kitchen. We look back at a lot of these 1950s, again, women's pages, and we see, you know, a lot of discussion of shortcuts and mixes and things that now seem so at odds with where we are in the fresh, you know, local seasonal food movement. And it's really important to remember that those were the technical advances that gave these women an opportunity to spend a little less time in the kitchen. And when the food editors got behind them, they were getting behind their fellow women.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. It sounds like, you know, they were like these super self-empowered women practicing this kind of proto-feminism.
Yeah, absolutely. They absolutely were. Unfortunately, what happened then is in the 1970s, when, you know, feminism becomes a really big movement, some of its leaders did not appreciate all that these women had done and really associated them with keeping women tied to the kitchen. And, you know, and absolutely, if you go through these older food sections, you absolutely see things about pleasing your husband. That is a trope that reoccurs and reoccurs. And so in response to that, a lot of the younger feminist activists really did not want anything to do with these women. And so these women who had been rejected by, you know, by their newsrooms, by their coworkers for years and years and years, although absolutely beloved by their audiences. I mean, these were the confidants for their communities. But they had a tough time in the workplace, and then they weren't any more appreciated by these younger women for what they had done.
Such a fascinating, complicated story. Thanks so much for coming in today, Hannah.
Thank you, Francis.
Hannah Raskin is food editor and restaurant critic of the Post and Courier in Charleston. And her story on the 1948 Virginia Chefs Tournament that sparked this conversation is in the Southern Foodways Alliance's quarterly magazine, Gravy. And coming up, real talk on slow cookers from America's Test Kitchen and Buddhist monastery cooking in Japan. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So I have a theory for why something as simple as a carrot tastes so much better when you're at a fancy restaurant. I mean, sure, the chef may have known that carrot by name and it may have been harvested by like an actual rocket scientist, but I think so much of it is because when we sit down for that meal, we know how much it costs. And that makes us actually take a moment to really concentrate on the carrot when we eat it, to really taste it. Well, it turns out my theory isn't new, or at least the idea of focusing on food as a mindful practice isn't new. In Japan, there's a long tradition of Buddhist cooking that is all about mindful cooking and eating, to connect yourself to your time and place. Abigail Leonard reports from Tokyo.
I'm here in northeast Tokyo in the bustling Asakusa neighborhood. There are lots of people on bikes and buses whizzing by. And I've heard about a monk in a temple here who specializes in Shojin Ryori, which is a kind of vegan temple cuisine. So I'm off to find him.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you. This is monk Kaku Hoeyoi, the chief priest of this 400-year-old Buddhist temple. He leads me into the main sanctuary. It's candlelit, red and gold and lacquer, and the air is heavy with incense. Aoi grew up here, learning to cook from his mother in the temple's small kitchen. He makes Shojin Ryori, the traditional vegan Buddhist cuisine that spread from China in the 6th century and laid the foundation for modern Japanese cooking. Today, he's making horenthal, a kind of leafy green.
This is a very traditional recipe. So just soy sauce and sugar, And sesame is very, very simple.
So simple, in fact, it doesn't use any onions or garlic. No Shojin Ryori cooking does, because, Aoi says, monks found it interfered with chanting sutra.
We will have the same small room and a lot of people. So if we eat a garlic and onion, it smell, stink.
Right, so it's just a sociable thing to do.
Yes.
So what do you use then? What other sorts of strong flavors do you have to work with?
For example, we have ginger, or we have a lot of herbs.
He slices the greens and the whole thing goes in the bowl. Ends, stalks, everything.
Actually, this is edible.
In this tradition, nothing goes to waste. Aoi saves vegetable peelings to make stir fries. The seaweed he used for stock becomes pickles. Every life and every bite is precious.
In the temple, when we eating a food, just concentrate the food. For example, when I bite the sesame seeds, maybe sound like pss, pss, pss. So just concentrate in front of you. It's very connected to the meditations.
Aoi wasn't always such an adherent. After college, he resisted his Buddhist birthright and moved to California, a place he'd only heard about in movies. He enrolled in an MBA program and started planning a career in business. But then the Twin Towers fell, and he felt powerless to help.
So I come back to Japan and study about Buddhism. After that, we have a big earthquake, 2011. It was very big difference between the 9/11.
So that time you felt like you were useful, you could be useful.
Yes.
Now, in a country where population decline is expected to shutter a third of all Buddhist temples, Aoi's congregation is thriving. It's up to 1,000 people, in part because he holds regular dinners and also dining in the dark events, where guests learn to really focus on food by eating blindfolded.
Do you feel like you really found your calling?
Yes. Now I don't have any money. Before becoming a monk, I'm happy because I have a lot of money. I'm happy because I have a girlfriend. But now I just say I'm happy because I'm just happy.
So is it possible to find that kind of spiritual satisfaction cooking, say, your average weekday dinner? To find out, I visited a Buddhist cooking class. Students at Akasaka Tehran learn to make temple food at home, the old-fashioned way. Instead of using a blender to mix tofu, the teacher coaches them to use a mortar and pestle.
Kamo-san is handling this very well. When you do it right, there's a proper sound you can make with this action.
The teacher, Masami Aseo, who is also a Buddhist priest, says these techniques are central to Shojin Ryori.
The whole point of Zen is to face yourself, and Shojin Ryori shares that idea. You look at the ingredient, focus on it, and I think ultimately that's the same as looking into yourself.
Today's menu includes things like edible chrysanthemum, persimmons, and lotus root.
Shojin ryori is seasonal food by nature. So the idea is that you're enjoying the season and that you can actually recognize the season by eating it.
The challenge, though, is the limited number of seasonal vegetables. Like, how many ways can you cook a radish? So top Shojin ryori chefs are masters of improvisation. And one of the best is right across town.
That was the traditional chimes that go off every day in Tokyo at 5 p.m. This restaurant is in an area called Roppongi that's really popular with foreigners.
Sometimes as many as half our dinner guests are non-Japanese. I want to show them Japan's beautiful Buddhist food culture.
Michelin-starred chef Daisuke Nomura opened this restaurant, Sugo, a year and a half ago. The kitchen is gleaming stainless steel. But there are also the telltale signs of traditional temple cooking. And there are colanders just filled with flower petals here. So there's one bowl that has this really beautiful sort of pale pink flower and another with these long yellow petals. This is not your grandfather's Shojin Ryori. Nomura's menu borrows from Chinese, French, even pub food. And Sugo recently became one of Tokyo's first restaurants on Uber Eats, the new food delivery service. So now you can eat ancient Buddhist temple cuisine in the comfort of your own home. Don't confuse this for just another vegetarian takeout place, though.
This type of food is certainly good for vegetarians, but there's a difference. In Shojin Ryori, you emphasize other people over yourself. I'm not saying vegetarians are self-centered, but many do it for health reasons or personal ideology. Buddhist cooking is an offering to someone else. That's the guiding principle, and you can taste it in the food.
Abigail Leonard is a Tokyo-based reporter who covers Japanese culture and politics. And by the way, Chef Daisuke Nomura says he hopes to bring that experience to a new restaurant in the U.S. Every week, we check in with good people at America's Test Kitchen for some hands-on info and advice for making our cooking and eating better. This week, it's the last word on slow cookers. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, sat down with Lisa McManus, ATK's queen of equipment testing.
Hey, Lisa, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
So you wrote something about slow cookers that I must read aloud because I think you have just captured the fantasy. You wrote, "A slow cooker promises to be a little fantasy grandmother who sits in the kitchen all day cooking for you." That's pretty perfect.
That's pretty true. I think that's what people really want from their slow cooker.
It's the expectation, but alas, it is not always the case.
Yeah, unfortunately not. I mean, if you have the wrong slow cooker or, you know, maybe not the greatest recipe, you can put stuff in there, but it doesn't really come out the way you were hoping.
So tell us what we should be thinking about when we're going to buy a slow cooker.
Well, now we've tested them a number of times, and I just recently updated this with all new models. And basically, what we know we like is a good size capacity of at least 6 quarts.
So bigger is better.
A little bit bigger is better, yeah, because you want to be able to fit a whole recipe in there, and leftovers are great, and 6 quarts is about the right size.
Okay.
And we also like an oval cooker because you can fit larger roasts and things without crowding. And we really like having a glass lid. Believe it or not, there are some that don't have glass lids. You can't really see what's going on in there. And then you're tempted to open it. And every time you open it, you're really losing a lot of heat and slowing down the whole process.
Okay, well, those all make sense. The problem with slow cookers is erratic heat, correct? Is that still the case?
Yeah. One of the things that we found in the past is there'll be hot spots or worse, you know, they just keep heating up until they're boiling. And they boil the heck out of your food, and it's pretty flavorless at the end of the day.
So you took some apart, I heard.
Yes, we tested 8 different models, and I bought a full set of them that I was just going to dismantle. You know, right? I just take them apart. But I really wanted to know, like, why are these different? Because from the outside, they all look kind of similar.
And how do they heat?
Well, the most basic one is a sort of a metal housing on the outside, a ceramic pot that goes inside, a lid on the top. And inside that metal housing, it's usually hollow, but it has one thing in it, which is like a belt that goes around the lower third of the cooker. And that's what's inside your toaster. You know, when you look down your toaster, you see those little glowing wires.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrapped around this belt all the way around the cooker inside that housing. So those are the classic slow cookers with a ceramic insert, mm-hmm. but we found another type. They have a metal insert, which is thin and lightweight. And instead of having that belt of wires that goes around it and heats it up gently from the outside, it sits on a metal hot plate.
Hmm.
And those cooked, understandably, a lot faster. And so what we kept finding in those cases is that we had to really check early. But people like them who can't wrestle with a giant ceramic pot. You know, some of those are like 8 pounds and
wow.
Empty.
You know, there are so many with so many settings on it that I don't want to touch it because I have to get out a manual every time I'm going to use my slow cooker. Did you take that into consideration?
We did. A bunch of them were a pain because there's so many buttons and it wasn't a logical mm-hmm. layout on the display. And you'd be thinking, okay, is it on?
Right.
And that's a terrible feeling because we've had ones in the kitchen where you think you've said it. You come back at 4 hours later and nothing
there is
has
no
happened.
Dinner.
Yeah, right. You go off for the day to work thinking, yay, I'm going to have a nice hot dinner and there's nothing and you've got spoiled food you have to throw out. And our winner, every time people got to that one, they were like, oh, look at that. Bing, 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 on. And it starts counting down right away. So you can see that it's on.
So which one was the winner?
Our winner was the KitchenAid 6-quart slow cooker with a glass lid. It's about $99. It holds 6 quarts. And here's the other thing. A lot of them that say they're 6 quarts, when we measure the actual capacity, you know, you can't fill it right up to the top. Some of these were 6 quarts. If you filled them right up to the rim and then don't move because something's going to go.
Right.
There was one more that I have to tell you about. It was a smart slow cooker. And
uh-oh.
It used, yeah. It used an app on your phone to control it. And we thought, oh, yay, this is the future. Except it was ridiculous. You had to have the app to see anything. You couldn't walk by and say, oh, I've got 3 hours to go. You had to fire up your phone and check it. And then sometimes it would sort of jump around and you'd think, oh, darn, I just turned it off. You know, that was not a good feeling.
We want a grandmother in the kitchen in that case.
Yeah, you want your grandma there. You know she's going to be there making your dinner. That's what you want. And our winner really gave that to us.
That's great. So I know you guys are constantly fooling around in the test kitchen. What are some of the more unusual things that you figured out to make in a slow cooker?
We have been able to make the most amazing monkey bread in the slow cooker. It acts as a proofing box, and then it fully cooks the dough. So we take advantage of that warm, moist heat. It's amazing. I mean, this is actually a recipe that's going to be coming out in our new cookbook this fall called The Complete Slow Cooker. And word is already out in the test kitchen. This is good stuff. We also make pad thai in the slow cooker. We braise the pork, and then we use the liquid to cook the noodles. We've made paella. Where we're layering the rice with the chicken and the sausage, and it gives you this amazing dish at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So we can really do a lot of crazy but delicious things in there.
Who needs a grandmother?
Right, she's been replaced, sadly.
She's been replaced. She's off the hook. Hey, Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus is the executive editor of Equipment Testing and Ingredient Tastings at America's Test Kitchen. You can get the details on their slow cooker tests and a recipe for slow cooker Memphis-style wet ribs at splendidtable.org. And coming up, a Michelin-starred chef's quest for vegetable greatness. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, I get to talk with you. Give me a call at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or on Twitter or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. So we have Terrence calling in. How are you doing, Terrence? What would you like to talk about today?
Well, I was wondering about morels and, well, cooking them real fancifully. I can, you know, butter and garlic is like the extent of my morel wizardry, and they just seem to lose it whenever you get real, you know, god-awful flavors. Beef, it's a bit much. Like macaroni and cheese and morels, perfect.
Yeah.
It's weird, but that's a top of the list these days, I hear. And
I totally buy that. Yeah, so, I mean, with morels, you said sort of a key thing, how do you cook them fancy? And there's certainly many, many ways to do that. I've seen very, like, oat preparations of them, and we can talk about a few of those. But to be completely honest with you, I learned about morels when I was living in Michigan, and they're a huge deal there in the season. People get really, really excited about looking for them. And to me, they always are that moment of spring, and they're always about just tasting them and not trying to do too terribly much to them. So what you said, butter and garlic, I think is fantastic. I actually like them with beef. I think they have a nice, like, woodsy flavor that goes well with beef, but I can totally see if like what you're saying, if you have maybe too much beef to too little morel, and you know, then that balance kind of tips over a bit. So you could also try the other direction. And I actually really like them with shellfish, with shrimp, or, you know, if you want to spring for some lobster, and just have them sort of simply sauteed alongside shellfish. I think it's really delicious. I've seen them stuffed with like a shrimp mousse and then cooked whole. And it's a fun thing to do, but, you know, it's it might feel a little frilly. What you do is make sure you get the big ones. You know, obviously, you sound like you really know your way around them, so you know to clean them well because a lot of dirt gets in those little honeycomb kind of compartments. But once they're clean, you basically can take some shrimp, maybe some whitefish or scallops, some cream, salt, pepper, and just buzz them up real well in a food processor until it comes almost to a paste. Don't overwork it so it becomes too tacky and too sticky. When you start pureeing proteins like that, it's almost like if you're doing working a bread dough. It's almost like when you're getting the gluten going. So it'll start to get tough if you keep going like that. But if you do it with a nice amount of cream, it'll keep it nice and soft. And once you get that going, you could throw them in a bottom of a Ziploc bag and kind of squeeze it till it's all in one corner. Use a pair of scissors and snip that corner out and just kind of pipe them into each morel. And what I like to do from there is you can do a little butter, start them in a little butter just to start getting them going. You can do shallots and garlic and maybe add a little bit of vegetable stock or chicken stock, or if you have some, you know, shrimp stock or something like that, just a little bit, and just braise them till they're nice and tender and that shrimp on the inside cooks, and, you know, throw in a little butter in the end, maybe some herbs, and stir it together so it's a nice little sauce, and I think you're pretty good to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my little Pavlovian bell is dinging, man. That's great. That sounds great.
Cool.
Okey-doke. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, great
good
to talk to you.
Good luck this spring.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much for talking today.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. So we have Will calling in. Hey, Will, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing, Francis?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
I'm calling about a Thai appetizer called Myeon Kham. Don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
When
I lived in Thailand, I had it frequently, and I can't find the right kind of leaf in which to wrap the fillings. And I'm wondering if you had any suggestions.
Oh, wow. Where'd you live in Thailand?
Chiang Mai.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's in the north. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah. Super jealous. I have some friends who are Thai chefs, and they are always saying, like, oh, you need to come here. And I mean by come here, never leave ever again.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Just go and eat and eat and eat.
Yeah. So actually, for the folks at home, can you describe Myeon Kham and why you love it?
Well, it's lots of little chopped up things, chopped up peanuts, ginger, little dried shrimp, and you put it in a leaf, wrap it up with a little packet, put a little sauce on it, and eat it. And it's just kind of this great, bright, fresh mix of flavors. And it's just a little appetizer.
Yeah, it has this explosion of all these different flavors and textures. And it's like crunchy and chewy and like aromatic. And I love it. And I'm so psyched you're asking about it. So I think it's traditionally made with something called betel leaf, right?
Which betel leaf, like right.
Yeah, it's floral and aromatic herb.
And and I've tried spinach, but that just, it wasn't maybe sturdy enough.
Yeah. So I actually think that you can use lots of different greens. I think originally it was made with tea leaves, funny enough.
Oh.
But I saw a chef named Susan Feniger in L.A. once. She did something I thought was brilliant, which was she took collard greens. And yeah, not the really, really mature ones, because those are a little bit too tough. But any collard green you would use as a salad, tender enough for that. It doesn't have the same flavor, obviously. It's not that same sort of floral flavor, but it has really good sturdiness, and it's like it kind of adds its own chewiness to it, which is another texture to add. And she took a cookie cutter and just started popping circles out of it. You know, it was like a 3-inch circle or whatever, and it was like the perfect size for you to fill with, like you said, like chopped up roasted peanuts, or, you know, finely diced ginger and diced shallots and chilies if you want it. And she actually did this thing too that I don't know if it's traditional, but I thought it was amazing. She took whole limes, like peel and all, and dice those super fine. And I was like, oh, isn't that going to be like too bitter or too sour? And just a piece or two of those in there. And it was just so explosive. It was so great. And you set it all out in little bowls and people can make their own bites. So like if you like it more sour, you put in more of the lime, you like more peanuts, you like more of the toasted coconut, or more of the dried shrimp. You can do whatever you want.
Right. Excellent. Now, while we're on the topic, do you have any suggestions for making the sauce?
Yeah, the sauce. Oh, we haven't even talked about the sauce yet. the sauce is super cool. It's like this really kind of funky, like fish sauce caramel.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of dab it on and add sweetness and it adds like savoriness.
Yeah.
There is a Thai cookbook author. He's not Thai himself. He's, I believe, British Australian, but he's spent like I think 30 or 40 years in Thailand researching Thai cuisine. And in the English language, he's really one of the great authorities. And his name is David Thompson. He has a few books. One of his books, which is totally classic, it's like an encyclopedia. It's just called Thai Food. And I steal lots of stuff from him.
Okay.
So the sauce I would use for this, which is kind of stolen from him, is 1 cup of palm sugar.
Okay.
And then it's very easy. It's 1/4 cup of water, 1/4 cup of fish sauce, and like just shy of 1/4 cup of tamarind juice. And you basically put the four together. I think he has a better technique than this, but you know, in my sort of dumbed down head, I think, okay, you just throw them all together, bring them to a simmer, let it simmer just a little bit so it gets a little bit thickened. You can add mashed up chilies, some of that dried shrimp if you like, some mashed up toasted peanuts or coconut. But that's basically the sauce. And once you sort of let that cool, that becomes your little caramel that you can sort of drizzle on top of each bite.
That's your sauce. Yeah, I think when I've made it in the past, I've been missing that tamarind flavor. So that's a really good suggestion.
Right on.
Well, all right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Again, our number, anytime we have voicemail, we are up to date in that kind of technology, is 1-800-537-5252.
Chef Daniel Patterson is one of the best, truly most thoughtful chefs in the world. He has a bunch of restaurants in San Francisco, and he became famous for dishes like a bowl of grits that's really buttered popcorn, or a rose that's made out of beets. Now, his cooking isn't really vegetarian, but it's vegetable-centric, and his understanding of the flavors of plants is really unlike anyone else's. I sat down with Daniel to talk about his way with vegetables.
So hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Daniel, I remember the first time I came to Kwa and sat down and had the tasting menu. I was so blown away by the simplicity of it and how clear the flavors were and how surprising the textures were. I remember this really wonderful beet snow with rose and this upside-down tomato tart with these super intense little tomatoes. And, you know, I was so sad when it was over, but I also remember realizing that, wow, after 11 courses, I was counting, and there were only 2 that had any kind of meat or fish. Are you weaning your guests towards vegetarianism?
I'm hopefully not weaning them towards anything except delicious food. You know, I'm not vegetarian. I love cooking with vegetables, but you know, there's kind of a crossover between what I like personally and what we serve in the restaurant, but it's not 100% one for one. So I don't go in with any kind of agenda except to make people happy. That's my agenda.
But let's talk about the focus on vegetables. What do you enjoy about cooking with them? It seems like you're really inspired by them.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, I've tried to think about where did this come from? You know, I didn't necessarily grow up with it and I didn't learn it anywhere. When we talk about vegetables, we're talking about plants. And the whole right. plant kingdom is so vast. So we work with wild plants. And wild plants, it's like wild sage. There's 100 kinds of wild sage, and the same variety in 2 different places is going to taste totally different. It's like being a painter, and someone gives you 100 new colors that no one's ever seen before or no one usually works with. Your ability to create something kind of fresh and new and to kind of look at the world in a new way is vastly increased. Mm. So what it does is it's like if you think about cooking as a language, vegetables give you a lot more vocabulary than if you're just cooking with meat. Because the fact is that different varieties of meat are going to taste much more similar than different varieties of a particular kind of herb or vegetable.
Yeah. Can you think of a dish that you've served that really makes you think, wow, that really shows something new about this plant?
I mean, you know, what I hope is that, you know, every dish shows a little something. So it's like, I guess one of the things that we try and do is combine familiar and strange in a way that so familiarity is connection to culture, connection to tradition. I mean, food is about people, so we want to keep that connection to other people. And everyone, you know, I'm just one speck on a long continuum of cooks over thousands of years, and I want to keep that connection there because that's where the emotional power is. But something new that you haven't seen before, well, that's like the shock of, you know, like excitement, you know, when you combine the two. And, you know, for example, the beet dish that you mentioned, the beets basically made into to look like a rose, cut in such a way, very labor intensive, a little bit of aerated yogurt and rose petal ice. Mm-hmm. And the rose petal ice is just made like a tea. It's only five ingredients. And so that's the other thing we try and do. And something that I personally love is the challenge of making something with something really humble and making it as exciting as if the customer was getting something really foreign or kind of a traditional luxury ingredient. So to make, I mean, let's be honest, to make a beet as exciting as, you know, caviar or foie gras is, you know, it's got to be a pretty damn good beet.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the amount of creativity and imagination that goes into it, you know, when you're creating kind of a little bit of a limitation, I think limitations kind of force creativity.
Yeah.
What I would hope is like I've just eaten a beet that tastes intensely of beet, and yet the form is different, and what it's surrounded with is different, and the temperature and texture is not what I was expecting. So I get what I thought I was going to get, and then something a little bit more too.
But you know, at the same time, you're also saying, well, one of the reasons why you love working with vegetables is because they add so many colors to your palate. In a sense, they relieve you of limitations or sort of a sense of what a limitation might be. At the same time, you also say you wouldn't want to be a vegetarian, that there's something about animal food, there's something about meat and fish that satisfies you in a way that just plants usually don't. What do you love about those foods?
It's a much bigger conversation around vegetarianism versus omnivorousness, let's just say.
That's not a culinary point of view. Yeah, just from a deliciousness point of view.
Yeah, no, but I mean, even if you're talking from a deliciousness point of view, because then you're getting into the physiology of how your body responds to animal fats, which is very well. So the perception of deliciousness, for example, we have on the menu right now, lamb that's poached in oil that's a little bit kind of tinged with rosemary, and then it's at a low temperature, and then it's grilled over charcoal to finish it. And the smell of that is just like mouthwatering. It has its own kind of appeal and deliciousness, and it satisfies a certain kind of craving in a different sort of way. I feel like I could replace that, but the fact is I don't cook in a vacuum, and I'm not cooking for some abstraction of what I think is a perfect meal.
Right.
I'm cooking for customers, my customers, and I've learned what my customers like and don't like, how far I can go, and what's really important. What I've learned is that it makes them happy to have that one thing, that primal sort of piece of meat, really well cooked, well cared for, like well raised, delicious. But if there's one moment of that in the meal, it's enough. And why, I guess, you know, again, going to this kind of how we're built as human beings, there's something about that plus how we're raised. So our culture is built on animal consumption. So our memory, our taste memories are geared towards craving animal. If we had grown up in a different society, I would be able to cook differently.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
Because
absolutely.
if I leave that out, there's one thing to bend people's expectation. It's another thing to break it entirely past a point at which they become disappointed. Because restaurants and cooking, it's all expectation fulfillment. And the thing, the bedrock, the most important thing at Qua that we feel, we're cooking for people. We're not cooking for ourselves. And they would be disappointed if we did not have at least that one moment of a perfectly cooked, aromatic, just really kind of juicy and kind of almost that primal experience kind of piece of meat at one point in the meal.
Yeah.
And so that anchors, in a sense, and allows us to do what we want for the rest of the meal. And it gives us a lot of leeway.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Daniel Patterson's latest book, written with the perfume maker Mandy Aftel, is called The Art of Flavor. And he left us with a recipe for beets, bergamot, mint, and wildflowers. And you can find that, of course, on splendidtable.org. And that's our show for this week. Thank you for listening, as always, and come back next week when we're all about oysters. And be sure to check out splendidtable.org, where you can find more info on pretty much everything you heard here today. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, which helps you eat well Monday to Friday. You can always find past episodes in our podcast archives. There's a ton there, so we can always stay close. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Teresa Burgess. Jennifer Lupke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.